of the same category as Julian Assange. In the eyes of the state, what differentiates you, what divides you from him, is only the degree. We share the same guilt. Each of us share in the crime, and we are unindicted co-conspirators. In his quest to raise a lantern in the halls of power.
NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden speaking Friday from Moscow at the Belmarsh Tribunal in London, named for the Belmarsh Maximum Security Prison where Julian Assange is being held. The tribunal, organized by Progressive International, will link to the full event at democracynow.org. An extradition hearing for Julian Assange will be held on Wednesday. Special thanks to Navarra Media. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe, wear a mask, save lives.
Listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in Philomath at 104.3 FM. And we're streaming at the top of
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
One, two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
David D., Hard Knock Radio, hanging out with you this afternoon. We're continuing our discussion with various folks to talk about a number of issues, primarily looking at the 55th anniversary of the founding of the Black Panther Party. We've been getting analysis. We've been looking at various aspects of history, and I definitely could not complete these conversations without talking to former political prisoner, former member from the East Coast chapters in New York in particular, Daruba Bin Wahad. Daruba, I wanted to talk to you for a couple of reasons. One, when we talk about the Panthers, what often isn't spoken about is the BLA, the Black Liberation Army, and that whole wing and that whole history. I know there's stuff that you've written about, you know, as a book. I know that was something that you were deeply involved in, which is why you became a political prisoner. But it's also a history that is only time it really surfaces for a lot of people is when the police want to talk about a war against them. And then they will show clips, you know, from 50 years ago and say there's a war against us and try to equate it to something that's going on today. But there really was a particular type of politic that was carried, a particular type of history that was, you know, that was laid out and it's been a race and a particular approach that people like yourself and others had. And when we look back at 55 years, I wanted to see if maybe we could touch on a little bit of that history, as well as, you know, where do you see things now? What lessons should we have learned? Should we be picking up and carrying? And, you know, what were some of the pitfalls? So welcome to the show, and thank you for having this conversation with us.
Well, first, thanks a lot, Davey. You know, I really respect your program, and I respect you immensely because, as you pointed out in our little back and forth in the mail, you know, we have to change the parameters of the dialogue, of the debate, because the institutions and the status quo set the parameters of all issues that are important in our lives today. And anyone that argues an analysis or a position outside of those parameters is considered either a crazy person, suicidal, a maniac, sellout, or whatever. So I really appreciate the role that you try to play, even though it's a difficult role, David. I got to give you props, bro. I couldn't do it. So I want to answer your last part of your pretty involved question last. Okay. First of all, there can be no real dialogue, no real change in the white supremacist cultural and political construct that the United States actually is in the 21st century without an equal distribution of the pain. There has to be a democratic distribution of the pain. That's what democracy means. And as long as there's not that paradigm, as long as there's not that tension, then a lot of the other struggles that seek to ameliorate the suffering of people, of our people, that seek to change the economic subservience of the domestic colonies that are the urban areas that we live in, the depressed urban areas, would be futile. And that implies, of course, that without an abolitionist movement rather than a reform movement, no change is really possible. This is why we continually revisit struggles that we've already won. We've already won the Voting Rights Act in 64, but we're still revisiting access to the polls and voting rights. You know, 40 years later, 30 years, 35 years, 40 years later, we're still fighting the same fights we fought since Reconstruction. And most of those battles we've won. And so having said that, what do I mean? What am I talking about? You know, I hate to say this about a lot of my comrades in the party, especially those on the West Coast, but one of the things that a lot of the OGs and brothers and sisters who were in the party seem unable to communicate to this generation is an understanding that without a historical connection to the Black radical tradition in a white supremacist society, we will be unable to build any type of effective movement, any type of movement that could build on the successes and the failures of the past. One of the major contributions of the Black Panther Party in the 1960s was not that we had breakfast programs, was not that we had free health clinics, although the Panther Party is portrayed today in almost every memorial as a social service group of committed a young Black community activists with guns. We were just like a social welfare unit, basically, that weren't getting paid by the state, and we just had guns, and we were talking some macho posturing. Okay, that wasn't the case. The Black Panther Party and its 10-point program, if you go back and read it, the 10-point program was not a revolutionary program in and of itself. It was basically a reform program. But the parts of the Black Panther Party's program that stood out the most, that threatened the status quo the most at that time, was point number 7. And that was looking at the police as armed agents of the state occupying our communities like a foreign army. And their role in our community was to do exactly what they're doing today. And that was to intimidate us, to brutalize us, to throw us into fear, and to turn our youth against the interests of their own communities and their own parents. And this is what they did. And they were only successful in this endeavor because of the cowards that came out of the war on poverty, the poverty pimps that we, many of whom are still in political office today. You know, the Black and legislative, the Black Congressional Caucus came out of the movement, came out of the movement that moved, that had solidarity with other people's liberation movements, especially South Africa and the anti-apartheid movement, especially the Palestinian struggle against the white supremacist settler state of Israel. You know, this Black and Puerto Rican Congress, caucus came out of these struggles, the struggles for tenant housing in urban areas, the struggles against police unions. All of these things, all of these struggles are the ones that fuel the election of many young activists to go into the party, go into electoral politics and mainstream politics. Unfortunately, whenever you have a radical movement and radical activists that go into the Democratic or Republican Party to effectuate change, that's where they go to die. That's where they go to become irrelevant. That's where they go to be co-opted. And that has proved itself. If any investigation of our radical history could show anything else, it could show that. And so when we talk about the Black Panther Party's legacy in real terms, in concrete terms, what are we talking about? The Black Panther Party in 1969, I believe, called for a national united front against fascism. And this call for a national united front against fascism was called by the Black Panther Party because the Black Panther Party leadership at that time, before it moved to the right, saw that the consolidation of the police state, the consolidation of the state and the right and right-wing political parties, especially Democratic and Republican parties, their pushback against the successes of the civil rights era in 64, 65, 66, 67, the pushback was the war on crime. The pushback was the so-called police congressional acts. Congressional
the ominous acts. Crime bill, would that have been it?
Yes, that was one of the legislative ominous crime bill, yes. The construction of the DEA under Nixon. As we see now, we see that that was mimicked after 9/11 with the construction of Homeland Security, another agency. And we know that the DEA was heavily involved in South America in counter guerrilla activities. The DEA was used to go after liberation movements, was to go after the Sandinistas, was to go after the movements in Latin and Central America. But my point here is that when the Black Panther Party called for a united front against fascism in 1969, it was because the Black Panther Party was seen by the left, white and left, by the peace movement, which is swelled to millions against the Vietnam War, that the Black Panther Party saw that we were moving towards a neo-fascist or a consolidated police state. And that if we could avoid this consolidation, if we could consolidate the left across the spectrum, across the racial and ethnic divides, across gender, across all of these divides, then we could build a national front that was strong enough to challenge the military-industrial complex and the militarization of police at that time. And 7,000 activists showed up at the conference for a national front against fascism.
It was a conference?
Yeah, it was a three-day conference.
Wow, when did this take place?
1969. And you don't never hear about this at the festivals.
No, you don't.
I'm telling you why. The reason why is because the Black Panther Party by 1971 had moved to the right. Leadership of the Black Panther Party had moved to the right. Whether they moved to the right out of fear, whether it was moved to the right out of opportunism or the criminalization of some of the major leaders in the Black Panther Party, it might have been a combination of all three. But that was the essence of the split in the Black Panther Party, its move to the right. And it moved into electoral politics. It moved into slinging yayo in the Bay Area. It moved into all of those things that we now see as corrupt Black politicians, as ineffectual electoral politics. Because the Black Panther Party realized when we started out that all politics politics was local. And today, all politics is local. And the Black Panther Party's full effect came into that paradigm of, into that contradiction. Indeed, the Rainbow Coalition and the concept of the Rainbow Coalition was not just restricted to Fred Hampton and Chicago, but was a principle of solidarity and class consciousness of the entire Black Panther Party, you see. This is why we had alliances with the Peace and Freedom Party that ran Eldridge Cleaver as the vice president on their ticket. This is why we had alliances in New York with the Young Lords. This is why we had alliances with the Patriot Party. This is why we had alliances with the New Left, with the, war, the Youth Against War and Fascism, which was white in New York. The idea of a rainbow coalition was to establish the seeds for independent political party, a working class party, led by the most militant and revolutionary elements in the Black community. That was the strategic vision of the Black Panther Party. So it wasn't that we thought that electoral politics didn't mean anything and that we shouldn't get involved in it and we should just go out and shoot cops and all this crazy stuff that people tried to portray us in. It wasn't that at all. It was establishing an independent political movement that would then have the right to call for a plebiscite. Look at point number 10, that we would petition the Black community. They would have the right to vote for a plebiscite on whether we should be independent or not.
Let me ask you this, Daruba. I want to bookmark where you're about to go, but I want to get some clarity. And we've had this debate offline, but I want to have you lay out your position on record here. When we look back to, you know, what has been highlighted with Fred Hampton and the Rainbow Coalition, but as you pointed out, principles of solidarity was an edict that was being carried out throughout the party, or that was one of the ideas. What is the difference between this principled unity and what I think many people would hear you say and equate to intersectionality, which is, you know, I think in many people's minds is that that's what we're doing. We're intersecting these struggles. Is there a difference between what you're talking about and what we're talking about in 2021 when we say intersectionality?
Absolutely, it is a difference.
Okay.
First of all, everything occurs within a historical context. Just like we can't bring back the Black Panther Party today, you know, it's because the history and the context and the conditions have changed. However, the relationship between Black people in the United States and the overarching system of the European settler state that America began as, a white supremacist state. The United States is a white supremacist social, political, and economic construct. It hasn't changed that paradigm. Having said that, therefore, any movement by people who were enslaved by that system, any move by people who have been victimized and subjugated by that system and maintained in that subjugation had to be a revolutionary movement, had to be an abolitionist movement. You cannot reform the white supremacist construct of the United States. It's impossible. You have to have a revolutionary movement. And that's why the Black Panther Party recognized at that particular historical moment that the state was on the cusp of militarizing its police in an unprecedented way. You got to remember, before the raid on the Black Panther Party office in 1960 or 1969 or 1970, before that raid, before Fred Hampton was killed, I think it was 69 actually, a few months before Fred Hampton was killed when they raided the Los Angeles office, was the first time that the term SWAT came into the lexicon of American police. The first SWAT raid was on the Black Panther Party. And that was not by coincidence. That was not by coincidence. And our ability to resist that that raid and come out alive was not by coincidence, okay? So when we talk about intersectionality today, we're talking about individual oppression and individual experience, because most of the dialogue and the politics that we hear from so-called activists who push to the forefront their intersectional oppression have experienced personally in their lives a certain level of disempowerment, of marginalization, of exploitation and brutality and hatred. And they have pushed that to the front of the agenda. There is no revolutionary movement in history, and go look it up, in which the intersexual oppression of individual segments of the people subsume the national liberation of those people. And that's what you have today. That's what hashtag movements were. That's why hashtag movements have failed. That's why they continue to fail, because you cannot open yourself to encapsulation by the status quo with hashtag movements, intersectionality, and reforms. This is why you have more new LGBTQ legislation going on in DC and in the various capitals of other states than you have actual legislation that empowers Black people and Black tenants and Black folks. You really do. And why is that? Because it's easy to encapsulate individual intersectional oppression. You can't encapsulate the revolutionary movement, a revolutionary nationalist movement, okay? And that's the second part. The part is that intersectionality today does not recognize the fact that the African people in the United States have matriculated from chattel slaves to surplus labor, and that whole period, that whole historical period has put us in a position of a domestic colony, okay? Look at all the so-called police murders that have been going on since George Floyd and before. We got almost in every case, whether it was in most of these cities, DC, Baltimore, the mayor was Black. The police chief was Black, huh? Which tells you that being Black was not sufficient.
You mean being Black in office with power?
No, being Black period is not sufficient.
Okay.
But this is where the Rainbow Coalition comes, which brings me back to Fred Hampton, and why the movie Judas and the Black Messiah could be even named that, and everybody is throwing their hands up talking about it's a wonderful movie. If Fred was alive, he probably would have been a great Black leader. We know, and the Black Panther Party knew, that individual leaders did not revolutions make, okay? And although Fred was a dynamic speaker, he was a brilliant organizer, he was a fearless young Black Panther Party member, his murder occurred at a certain juncture in the repression of the Black Panther Party that nobody talks about. Because there was a move inside the Black Panther Party to democratize, to make more representative of the Black Panther Party chapters and branches, more representative in the Central Committee, which was dominated by the activists around Huey and around Bobby in California, okay? And Fred Hampton, like others in New York, were slated to be on that new formed Central Committee. And it resulted from a long struggle inside the Black Panther Party to live up to the principles of what the Black Panther Party called democratic centralism. The Black Panther Party was not an organization like the NAACP or even SNCC or any other organizations. The Black Panther Party was a cadre-based organization. In fact, it was the only cadre-based organization at that time.
What is cadre? What does cadre-based mean?
Cadre-based means that the organization was built around a specific ideology, had a specific principles of democratic centralism, in which the members had democracy and could implement democracy within the strictures of the party and the party's structure to influence its mass line. A cadre organization is much like, I guess to use a somewhat of an obsolete example, would be something like the Communist Party of China.
Can you give us an example of how that would look in real time? How would that play out, you know, in terms of executing an idea or an ideology? How would that play out under that rubric you described?
Well, if we have to understand how the Black Panther Party arose. After Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale stepped into history and did what they did in order to launch the Black Panther Party in the Bay Area, you know, many of the activists, many of the members, future members of the Black Panther Party and the chapters were organized in different cities. And I was a field secretary in the Black Panther Party. So I worked in a number of cities on the East Coast to organize new branches. But the field secretaries were under the field marshals of the Black Panther Party, and the field marshals were members of the first cadre of the Central Committee. Okay, so there was a hierarchy that was at once central, but subjected to the needs of each individual chapter and each individual state, because all politics was local, as I pointed out. And each city, whether it was Chicago or New York or Miami, had their unique features that came about as a result of the historical movement of Black people to those areas, whether it was Detroit and the auto industry, whether it was Chicago and the meatpacking industry, and whether it was Texas, wherever. So in order for the Black Panther Party to be truly a national organization that reflected the needs and the concerns of every chapter and every branch, it had to have a national central committee, and not a central committee composed of cronies and individuals from one area in the country. And so finally, the leadership in the party agreed that this had to be changed. So we established liberation schools in which so everyone could be indoctrinated and educated into what the party line stood for, what the Black Panther Party stood for, and in how to enhance that party line into what we would call a mass line in each individual area. Fred Hampton was slated to be on that new form National Central Committee, as was a few members of the Panther 21. This is why Fred Hampton was killed. That was the reason. Not because he was charismatic, not because he could speak so well, not because he was just an exceptional organizer, because every leadership in every chapter of the Black Panther Party by 1968, 1969 were actual activists who had been active in their communities before they joined the Black Panther Party. They already had credibility before they joined the Black Panther Party, okay? So these were community activists in different areas, in different parts, whether they were the Desire Projects in New Orleans, whether they were in Boston, whether it was wherever. But COINTELPRO tried to sidetrack and disrupt that, and they succeeded because of a whole bunch of reasons that we can get into, but I don't think we really need to get into that right now. But I just want to say that it was the consolidation of the Black Panther Party as the national organization, as a revolutionary organization that was capable of leading the left and the new left and the peace movement into the formulation of a new political party, of a third political party, and a political party which would be led by the Black Panther Party. Now, let me point this out, and it's very important to point out, because we have people today calling for reparations. We have people today, we have a whole bunch of activists, old timers, calling for another tribunal. I mean, we're going to do another tribunal. We're going to charge genocide one more time in the UN to go nowhere. A total waste of time, a total waste of energy. But they're doing it right now as we speak. They're reinventing failure. And these are old timers, you see.
Right.
So
go ahead.
You asked me how would that look? Just imagine if Black people thought as a sovereign people, which we don't. We don't think as a sovereign people. We think as people who want to integrate into the white supremacist culture and reform it so that it is more acceptable, would treat us with more respect, would treat us with more concern, would put our interests somewhere on the agenda, you know, to have a seat at the table, you know, so we could have, you know, Black dollars stay in the Black community, like that makes a difference under finance capitalism. You know, all of this bull, okay, that refuses to understand that power recognizes nothing without counterpower. That there has to be a democratic distribution of the pain. And that's where the BLA came in. Because once the enemy understands that they cannot kill you, they cannot murder you without a consequence, where they would suffer as well, whether it's economic, whether it's physical, whether it's military, they will never sit down and negotiate with you in good faith. White folks have never went anywhere on this planet you didn't have to kick their monkey ass out. Never. Never. Look at Afghanistan. They're 20 years, $2 trillion. Taliban is in power. And what do? They keep their money. They try to strangle the government. They run money into certain armed oppositions against the Taliban. They can't say they lost. The United States, out of its whole history, has only not been at war for 22 years. America is a garrison police state. Reforming it is impossible. Getting power within its confines is not. Okay? And these white folks on the left, on the right, are showing you that. They're showing you that they, in belief and pursuit of a lie and a buffoon like Donald Trump, they're ready to cause a new insurrection. They're ready to disrupt the whole corporate power structure and police state in order to protect their interests. Every white community in Idaho, in Alabama, in Georgia, everywhere has community control of the police. You got over 150 counties in Georgia. And in all of those, some of those counties only have 2,500 people in it, or 3,000 people. But all of the cops, all of the sheriffs, everybody knows them. They come from their families. They live in the community that they police. You understand? They have community control of the police. The only people that don't have community control of the police and decentralization of police are black people living in these urban areas, are the internal colonized people in the United States. So when the Black Panther Party moved to the right, and it moved away from consolidating power on the left and building a united front. When it moved away from that, it ensured that it would be encapsulated. It ensured that in the final analysis, our experiences in the radical tradition would be obscured by time and by seeming failure. This is why you have hashtag movements today that call themselves the Black Lives Matter movement rather than the Black Liberation movement. How can you say that your movement is based on the fact that you're telling your oppressor that your life matters? How your life matters if them crackers don't die too? Huh?
We're talking with Daruba Bin-Rahad, looking back at 55 years. We know that erasure of history has been the paramount tactic, one of the paramount tactics used against people who were oppressed or genocide, in particular Black people and our indigenous brothers and sisters. You know, so they were suffered through boarding schools, children removed from the homes, you know, and we're going to indoctrinate you all with this, you know, this settler colonial project ideology. Black people, at the threat of death, were not allowed to read everything. We know that history was stripped of the culture. And I would argue, and we've talked about this, that has never stopped.
So, not supposed to,
right,
yes.
It's always gone on. So we've had militant movements or attempts of it from the time we got in here. And with each iteration, with each generation, those movements have been forgotten. So there was a Maroon movement that nobody talks about, right? That has been completely obscured. We might see a little bit of it in the Sankofa movie, but there's no real understanding. You can't name the strategies, the people, the places, all that. That's almost been erased, which means that if you go from the Maroon movement to, you know, some of the armed struggles that were taking place post-Reconstruction, right? That would be maybe an extension of resistance, armed resistance, where, as you said, pain was distributed, that, you know, that emerged. I don't know, because we weren't around in the late 1800s, early 1900s, to see if they connected to the Maroon movements that happened during enslavement and those sorts of things. If we go from post-Reconstruction and whatever armed struggles we saw there, you get Marcus Garvey, right? So that's a whole movement onto itself. And we don't really all know the particulars. We know about the UNAI, we see some of the pictures, but we don't know what the strategy and the conversation. We know that he had beef with Du Bois, but we don't really know that full history. And I would argue that the Panthers coming up, you know, and this is, I'm just looking from the outside in, I'm not around to know, you know, one might suggest that maybe that was a reinventing of the wheel because some of these things had already started. Now, I know you all were students of history and you all look back and it was a very particular way, you know, that was part of the thing. Let's just get this political education. Hopefully, so you don't reinvent the wheel, but nevertheless, a young generation, when you were 19 and 20 and Afeni 19 and 20 and Huey 19 and 20, these were folks that, you know, from the outside looking in, you could say they're reinventing the wheel. Marcus and other people already did this, you know, and you had to figure it out. 40, 50 years later, people like yourselves have been in jail. We still have political prisoners in jail, you know, whose legacies and contributions have been obscured and forgotten. People are in exile. We had a crack epidemic, you know, on top of a heroin epidemic and all sorts of things, the full weight of the state to completely leave us disarrayed. So by the time you get into the 90s, you got people damn near raising themselves, you know, and a lot of folks, heroes and sheroes, even people who are members of the party, you know, mm-hmm. caught up in that wave. You move into the millennium, you know, you've had a concerted effort to not just continue that erasure, but then to discredit, which was also an edict of COINTELPRO. So like if you walked in a room, and you've walked in a room, we've been in rooms with people like, I don't care if you've been in jail 20 years, you know, certain type of arrogance of youth, a certain type of arrogance of ignorance, a certain type of arrogance of seeds that were planted by the state to say that these people, we don't need to listen and get their wisdom and soak it up. So you definitely have a reinventing of the wheel. And I would argue, you know, since we're talking about BLA, that's 10 years, 13 years in the making, there will be a new generation that you see that come up that wouldn't even care about them, right? And that's within eyesight, much less everything else. So we know that a part of the state has always been to erase, distort, and at this point, to underscore it, and I'll pass the mic back to you. Let's make it a law that we can't even talk about these formations and this history in school. That's the whole, that's why that's a fault line. We'll make that a law. Like you can't talk about enslavement in Texas without putting the counter narrative to say that we were immigrants and that we, it was a good thing. You can't talk about the genocide. I mean, these are laws that are being passed.
I know, but they're being passed by white folks because they don't want to talk about their history.
Right,
but what you're talking about is far, far more deep. It's far deeper than that.
Okay.
Because it is the policy of all reactionary governments and people in power to disconnect each generation from the legacy of the previous generation.
Right.
You know, this is one of the reasons why the Vietnamese won their struggle. The reason why the Vietnamese won their struggle when they ran the French out after World War II and when they ran the Americans out after 15 years or whatever was that they didn't get the memo that they were supposed to lose. They didn't get that memo. Hmm. They passed on the struggle from one generation to the next, and the United States was unable to destroy the core of its leadership that could pass on these lessons to the next generation. And that's the most important thing to understand, is that history does not repeat itself. It rhymes, huh? History doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes. Remember the riots and stuff in Tulsa and where they wiped out entire black communities, and the one in Delaware, I think it was Delaware, and North Carolina or Delaware, where they wiped out the entire community, and the crackers that wiped out the black community then held rallies, massive rallies, to de-seat all of those legislators that didn't agree with that murder and mayhem and reinstitute and put into power their own representative. The exact same thing these crackers tried to do on January 6th, huh? History is repeating, it's not repeating itself, it's rhyming. If we don't understand this, that that was a prelude to the lynchings and murders that went on for a half a century under Jim Crow and segregation, okay? That was the result, emancipation, the failure of the government after the murder of Abraham Lincoln to hold the rebellious and an insurrectionist South to account, to hang Jefferson Davis, was all a compromise in order to put that in the past and move along. And this is why you have crackers waving the Confederate flag, talking about it was nothing but culture. Damn it, Davy. We know this. The Haitian Revolution was the revolution that the slave masters in the United States feared that the slaves would get knowledge of. A successful revolution by slaves to run out the French? Seriously? And look at Haiti today. Look at the conditions this Haiti's in today. Huh? We have to understand history does not repeat itself. It rhymes. Okay, and we're in another historical moment, just like the Black Panther Party was in 1969, just like the people were in Tulsa at the turn of the century when they were having all the riots. We are in a historical moment today when the national security state is reinstituting and reestablishing a whole new political system of democratic fascism. And what are we doing about it? We holding tribunals to declare genocide. We're talking about defund the police. You ever heard such a ridiculous statement? How do you defund the police in a national police state? How do you do that? You can't. Okay, it's not going to happen. That's why Biden gives a speech to the police unions and says, hey man, we're gonna give you more money. Did you expect he was going to do anything else? And the reason why you expect he was going to do anything else is fear. I'm going to tell you straight away. Huh? The black leaders that came out of the 60s scared. That's why they talked about black on black crime, to get away from the fact that they had to organize these kids in the street. Whose parents are these kids in the streets? Who's their parents? They shooting each other. Who's their parents? Who's the adults? Who's responsible? Them? So you have to understand that this disconnection between our historical legacy of radicalism has disconnected us from the ability to control our own communities, because we used to control our own communities. There was a time when the word neighbor and hood went together. It wasn't the hood, okay? So how did we lose that along the way? Crack, PCP, war on crime, this is how we lost it. And if we can't see that, I mean, Ray Charles is dead, but if he was alive, he could see that.
Okay. So can we restore that? Because I think everybody wants to restore remnants of that.
Yes, we can. But like I said, history doesn't repeat itself. We have to adjust ourselves to this historical moment. Where are we at today? Look at what's happening with Steve Bannon, you know, and Trump. And 85 plus million white folks who believe that he's still president, and who are ready to take up. And you got to remember that white folks is arming themselves to the teeth while we talking about gun control, huh? But we talking about taking guns out the black community, not talking about whose hands they are in the black community, because most of the people in the black community who own weapons own them illegally. And why do they own them illegally? Because for decades, they had programs of stop and frisk and racial profiling that made sure that the majority of young adults would have a criminal record and could never legally own arms. So what do we do with that? We talk about something like community control of police, not community review boards that have subpoena power. We talk about serious public safety, not just police, community control of public safety. That means fire, sanitation, healthcare, everything. Public safety should be, we should have public districts for public safety, where we elect our own representatives, where the police come from our community. They get trained maybe at a central academy, but their first 3 or 4 years are done in service. They have to live in the community, which means you have to set aside housing for police and public servants in our community, which means gentrification gets stopped in its tracks. Okay, there's a whole lot of implications. Black folks don't think these things through like that because they are afraid. And academia doesn't teach this history because they are afraid of losing their positions. They are afraid of being labeled black racist and supporting black crime and all of these things. It's fear. They could not disconnect us from our radical tradition if they didn't scare us away from it. And they did that. And you have a generation of Black kids, young folks, who are afraid. And so they believe that the only way to succeed is to become an entrepreneur, is to become, you know, some type of community worker that gets grants and all of this stuff. And this is not to denigrate their sincerity or their belief that they are trying to do something to elevate their people. I don't doubt their sincerity at all, Davey. But what I'm talking about, when we don't have a concrete analysis of our own radical history, this is what happens. They couldn't disconnect us from the leadership, the legacy of the leadership of the Black Panther Party, unless the leadership in the Black Panther Party disconnected themselves from what they stood for. And that's exactly what happened when the Black Panther Party moved to the right. That's exactly what happened. We really have to understand that the enemy fears this. You know, and I know, for decades, all of the repressive apparatus of the FBI and the Justice Department was aimed at the left, was aimed at Black radicalism and Black militancy. That was a legacy of COINTELPRO. How many Black young people know about Chesraw? How many Black people know about Newkill? How many Black people know about Prysack and Shamrock? These are all operations of the United States police agencies and law enforcement agencies that were aimed directly at subverting our ability and capacity for community self-defense. Our community has a right to self-defense. Now, with the changing climate and the catastrophes that's facing urban areas now, whether it's climate change or natural catastrophes, we have organizations like FEMA who are trying to train the population into becoming their own first responders. Are we taking advantage of that training? No. Are we talking about becoming our own first responders? No. Are we talking about what happens in the Black community or in say Chicago, if they decide to cut the water off? How do we get water? Do we have an alternative plan to that? Do we understand that all politics is local and we can't control that? No. What are we talking about? We're talking about getting the right to vote. Vote for what? Vote for what? To a Democratic Party agenda, huh? That's led by Pelosi and Schumer. A supporter of white supremacist Zionism, you know? I mean, AIPAC, I'm gonna give you two concrete examples of how we're wasting energy. Two strategies that we could bring forward that could educate our people. You know, right now, as we speak, David, there's a big debate about how law enforcement and the fire departments are refusing to be vaccinated.
Right.
And the unions are holding press conference talking about they're not going to get vaccinated. Cops are walking out or whatever. So what entity keeps our political prisoners in jail, David? The police unions. It's the police unions that keep our prisoners in jail. So have all of these radical lawyers who are calling for reparations and calling for all of these other things that are totally impossible, are they organizing themselves to have the police unions decertified? Have they gone to the Justice Department? And have they gone filed a civil suit against the five major police unions in the country to have them decertified? And why would you decertify the police unions? Because the police are not workers. The police are armed agents of the state. Let me repeat that. The police are armed agents of the state. They are not workers. And therefore, they should not have a union that defers upon them and confers upon them the same rights as ordinary workers who don't have the right to kill me and you based on what they call it, qualified immunity. Oh, I thought the nigga was going to do something. That's why I shot him 99 times. There's no civil servant that has that power and can get away with that. Mm. So if we make a move just to decertify the unions, we might lose it. But look at how massively it would educate the people to what exactly the police are. Why do the police unions have more influence in Black communities than the Black community itself? They're the ones that determine policies. They're the ones that influence politicians. Every politician that runs for office got to kiss their ring and say how they tough on law and order, how they tough on crime in order to get the union's endorsement, huh? You don't have to do that with the medical industry. You don't have to say, look, man, you know, we tough on having more hospital beds. So you be anti-insurance company. Okay. So what I'm trying to say to you is, when you reinvent failure, it's because you don't understand that we've been there and did that. We already put referendums on the books to decentralize the for community control of the police. And how did they fail? That's what you need to see, how they failed. So you don't reinvent failure. So
part of the erasure, Daruba, is to amplify voices, to fund voices that would continue that erasure. So we have a generation of people that have organized themselves around ADOS, for example.
Hashtag.
Right? That talk
around
about reparations.
Hashtag.
Yeah, that talk about reparations. So I have people now that are sitting there that don't know about anything from, you know, in Cobra on down. I like, this is a new thing, right? And when you look at the funding, as you know, Jared Ball, our comrade, has pointed out, you know, he traced the money. It's like, oh, it came from the Bannon folks damn near to make sure that those voices are loud and at a seat at the table. So we have a lot of that going on. And so you can't always directly erase people the way that it was done maybe a century ago. So what you do is you find agents to resurrect, and they will erase or they will distort.
But it's become easier though, not to cut you off, David, become easier because you got like that video I told you about, all hail the algorithm.
It's become
easier with social media, with the weaponization of data. So you have every buffoon or so-called genius on YouTube spouting conspiracy theories, talking about what the CIA does, what they do. You know, you have professors which, you know, that's establishing so-called schools and all of this stuff on YouTube. And if you take a camera, to the South Beach in Miami, you take the camera down there, and everybody that walks by past the camera will start posing like they a movie star on TikTok. Everybody. So you have organizations now. This is why you could have masses of people in the streets after George Floyd was murdered. Okay, on because it was on national media. You could have thousands of people in the streets, and they have failed to be organized. They have never, mass mobilization is not mass organization. And the reason why you can't organize anything, because the leaders of those movements were disconnected from their own radical history. They didn't even know this. The most conscious and revolutionary movement in my lifetime, decades after the 60s, was the Wall Street. Because they were the first ones to identify that less than 1/10% of the people on this planet control 90% of all of its wealth and controlled our lives. You had grandmothers, white women, come. It didn't become an issue until they start macing white housewives on Wall Street. Huh?
And it's spread around Occupy Wall Street.
Occupy Wall Street. So what I'm trying to say, this was a movement that went directly at the source of all of this misery, finance capitalism. This is the source and the basis of everything we're talking about. And the people that benefit from this construct, the people that benefit from white supremacy that has informed that construct, are going to make sure that any type of resistance to it is co-opted, is misdirected, and if necessary, suppressed brutally. And that's what happened to Wall Street. Obama participated in that. He called together all of the governors of the nation and said, we got to do away with this. And they did. And what was the weakness of the Occupy Wall Street movement? They looked at the 60s and said, well, if we have leaders and we have people that are spokespersons, they could destroy us. So everybody is a leader. Everybody got to have a say-so. So they didn't organize themselves. They could not resist. They could not organize a coherent Occupy Wall Street movement into a class party that would challenge the Democratic and Republican parties, that would challenge the rise of fascism in Europe. What we are talking about here, Davey, today is happening in Europe as well. It's not just here in America. And when we look around the world and we look at all of the people in the streets, whether they're in the streets in Lagos because of police excesses and police brutality and up in arms against the political elite, whether it's the Sudan who's felt betrayed by their revolutionary upsurge after Bashir was overthrown, whether it's in Beirut after the explosions, where everywhere we go, it's young people who are in the streets. People between the ages of 20 and 35, they have no future. They have no jobs. They're subjected to the whims of the police state and the murder by military. They have no power. They have no food. They have no income. This is global, and this is capitalism. This is new age imperialism. And so if we don't understand the historical moment we are in, we are doomed. And that's why I said history don't repeat itself. It rhymes. And we had a crucial historical moment right now.
If you're just tuning in, we've been talking with Daruba Ben-Wahad. And as you can see, we're just getting started. So we're going to have to hold this conversation over to tomorrow as we're going to continue this discussion. Before we do that, for people that's been listening to you, Daruba, can you tell them how they can get a hold of you? Also, we'll put up this entire interview in one fell swoop so you can get it on our website online. But we're going to continue the conversation for tomorrow. But how can people get a hold of you?
I have an email address, daruba@gmail.com, which I try not to really answer too much because I'm only joking. But I also have a webpage, darubabenwahad.com. And also, you have some of your co-journalists in the Black Power Media at Renegade podcast, and I mix what I like, and of course your show, because I think that when people get in touch with me through you guys, that they kind of like vetted.
Okay. So we can get a hold of.
Because I know you ain't gonna pass no stupid knuckleheads along.
No, we don't do that. It's daruba@gmail.com. Also, you can check out Daruba. He frequently is on the I Mix What I Like show with our counterpart Jared Ball.
And Black Power Media.
And Black Power Media. So we appreciate that. We're gonna continue this conversation tomorrow. We'll pick it up on Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio. I'm rocking with Picasso.
What?
And Maya.
Who?
My last name is Susana. Yeah.
Jeremy Scahill, author of Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from People's Food Co-op, a community-owned natural foods cooperative featuring farm-direct organic produce from more than 30 local farms, bulk foods, and a farmer's market every Wednesday year-round.